Welcome to the Claim Hunters. I am Chris Tidball, an executive claim consultant with Subro IQ, where we routinely find our clients significant amounts of trapped cash. On our show, we will explore the epidemic of trapped cash across not only the insurance industry, but the global business landscape. Our guests bring a unique perspective on challenges faced by businesses that impact their bottom line. We believe that everyone has a great story to tell, and this is the forum to tell it. We hope you enjoyed today's episode and stick around to learn more about how you can be a guest in 20 minutes or less. Welcome to the Claim Hunters. This is Chris Tidball, your host, and I am here with Steve Ellis, who is with Sedgwick. Welcome, Steve.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So what have you been up to at Sedgwick these days? I think you're in a newer role.
A couple of years ago, I took a role as their liability practice lead.
Okay.
And I always laugh when I tell people this, but I'm technically part of their thought leadership program.
Okay.
My wife spits coffee out when I tell her that. But it's been a lot of fun. And of course, liability right now is a pretty hot topic in the industry.
Yeah. It seems like negotiation has kind of become a lost art, and negotiating liability has gone right out the window with it.
I totally agree. Yeah, I've definitely seen a shift in kind of how we're approaching negotiations. And I think back to when, I was an adjuster 35 years ago and how I was trained on it. It's a lot different than how we train people today.
Yeah, it's interesting because we probably came up about the same time, different companies. But I think that there were a lot of the same training practices, right? I mean, you learned under fire, but you had a lot of prep. I remember liability exercises. I remember professionals coming in to teach us liability, and you guys probably had similar types of situational.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I one of the training classes that I took as a young adjuster, and I always thought it was really weird at the time, was called consultative selling skills.
Okay.
And I thought, I can't sell my way out of a wet paper bag. Like, why am I taking a selling skills course?
Right.
But that was the lead into our negotiation course.
Right.
And then when I finally realized that, you are selling a position when you are negotiating, and you have to use leverage, and you have to maintain relationships and find that common ground.
Yeah.
And sales is about finding a way through that.
Yeah. And it really makes sense. I remember when I first got into sales, years ago, after years of being an adjuster, the question came up, you really don't have any sales background. And it was, honestly, I've spent years as an adjuster. You're selling everything, under the sun. I mean, you're selling your position to body shops, you're selling your position to attorneys, to consumers, to insureds and claimants, because a claimant could become a potential insured, and upwards to your boss. And even as you move up into management, you're selling your position to leadership. And I mean, we do probably more selling than most people in sales.
Great.
It's crazy. But now I know you've been working on something negotiation related.
Yeah. Well, so one of the things that I haven't, and maybe I shared this with you, I don't know. So I also teach MBA courses. I'm an adjunct professor for a university in Michigan.
Okay.
And one of the courses that I taught was MBA negotiations.
Okay.
And the book that I used for that one was a book. It's an older book, but it's by a guy named G. Richard Schell, and it's called Bargaining for Advantage.
Okay.
And it is what I would call negotiation theory. My mind just kind of blew up when I read that book and then started teaching from it, because I thought, man, this book's about 35 years too late for me. And I wish I'd have had this when I first started. And then I started thinking about, well, how are we training adjusters today for negotiations? And most of that training is basically just the back and forth. You're trading numbers is what I see and hear a lot. And if you apply negotiation theory to your negotiations, you're going to get far better outcomes. Because, I mean, let's be honest with the state of liability today.
Right.
The non-litigated claims is where severity is really coming to be, right? Because you're settling far more than you're litigating. In fact, our own data tells us that only 1.8% of our claims go to trial. So you're settling the rest, and you're selling it voluntarily. It's whatever you can negotiate and settle it for And that will become, the severity for tomorrow. But we've seen that those numbers are going up.
Yeah, I mean it's crazy what we're, I mean, some of the stuff that we're seeing. I think I mentioned earlier, before the show, the $500 million verdict here in Orlando.
Right.
In insane. Now there was probably some negotiation there. I don't know. Obviously not to $500 million. But yeah, I think it's the numbers are really the problem because, as a plaintiff attorney, if I know I'm just playing the numbers game, then it just makes sense to ask for a whole lot of money.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I remember, back when I was adjusting claims, you'd get crazy demands. I want 100,000 or 200 or 500,000 on something that was like a garden variety soft tissue case. And the whole plan was to get you to start higher, where what you want to do if you really want to play numbers, I'm starting at $500. I mean,
Right.
if you really want to, because we're going to end up where I want to end up, not where you want to end up. But the effective way to do it is really let's focus on the facts of the case. You don't want to focus on the numbers at all. I mean, you want to focus on the liability. Why was your client 30% at fault for this? What were, what could they have done to avoid the accident? Did they have the last clear chance? Just basic things that adjusters should be talking about.
Right. Well, and those big numbers that the plaintiff attorneys, throw out, that has a technical name. It's anchoring, right?
Right.
They're anchoring with a really large number,
Yep.
hoping to get you to kind of set your expectations about where they're going.
Right.
But the correct response to that is not to throw out, a lower number or a number that you've evaluated it to. What I would do in the case where they're anchoring really, really high
Right.
is use some normative leverage in terms of like, all right, so I just settled a case just like this last week. You're telling me $100,000. I settled it for whatever it was.
Right.
And then, so tell me why is this different?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that
And
makes sense.
don't
Make
even throw out a
them,
number.
yeah. I remember there was a company years ago. It was called CyberSettle. Remember
Oh,
that?
yeah, I think I remember that.
And it was a cool concept. I mean, I give the guy a ton of credit who developed it. But it was all about numbers. It just reinforced that the adjuster didn't want to negotiate. And the attorney didn't want to negotiate. They just wanted to put numbers out there.
Right.
And they didn't even have to pick up the phone and call each other. They just sent it back and forth on the computer
Yeah.
until they got a number that they both agreed on.
I've seen some current products like that that do that exact same
I would
thing.
think that would lead to overpayments all day long.
Well, it's just a loss of a negotiation skill,
Oh,
right? Because
yeah.
it's not negotiating, it's just
No.
passing numbers.
It's a lost art. And I mean, I think, at the end of the day, when you think of like the role of the adjuster, I mean, all you do is negotiate.
Right.
That's what you should do,
Yeah.
but it sounds like that's not happening as much as it used to from
I
what.
don't think that it is. I mean, it's definitely people are under a lot of pressure. Their
Yep.
pendings are high.
Yep.
They want to get claims closed. They negotiate, if you want to call it that, with numbers, and they try to get to their number as fast as they
Your
can.
disposition. That's what it's all. I mean, that was a challenge, my own claims organization, it was. We were highly dependent on disposition. At one point in time, we actually rolled out a process where we kind of, blew up that whole concept of focusing on, obviously we kept focusing some on disposition, but the quality of the claim, right? So rather than focusing on just these numbers, let's focus on the quality and give you a total quality score. So
Yeah.
you kind of roll some, Deming concepts into it. And you look at things like, did you identify subrogation? Did you move the salvage? Did you get out there and make your 2 or 4 8-hour contact, your 24-hour inspection?
Right.
Did you drop the ball on coverage? I mean, that kind of stuff.
Right.
And
Well, the more to me, so the irony is that the faster you negotiate, the worse data shows, the worse your result's going to be. So you want to slow your roll. But we actually pressure our teams to settle as fast as they can. So like what's going on there? Why do we do that? And then from an early investigation perspective, and I say we, the industry, are trying to get the adjusters to move as fast as they can to get to the point where they can sell as fast as they can. Because what do we say? A closed claim is a good claim, right? But if we skip that step of really investigating well, because when you uncover that piece of information that is the critical leverage that you can use in negotiation,
Right.
that's where you really get a good outcome. But we're like rushing through the investigation, maybe not spending the time that we need asking, using critical thinking skills to ask those follow-up questions. We're not
Right.
uncovering the leverage that we need. And I think the fact that we've not uncovered the leverage that we need is probably what's deteriorating our negotiating skills.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said for that. I mean, think about this for a second. If you do an audit, right, and you look at 100 files, most of those are settled at zero or 100. You know, it's pretty rare that you see like a 50-50, hardly ever like a 60-40, 70-30. And but then you look at what jurors do, right? You have, you know, more than 50% of all claims are resolved, you know, in a courtroom with an apportionment of liability. So how is it that, you know, six or 12 jurors can sit there and they presumably don't know much about, you know, the law as much as an adjuster would. They don't really understand the concept of comparative negligence, yet they're, you know, they're looking, filling out the jury verdict form, you know, line one, 50%, line two, 50%, and you know, they're doing it more than half the time. It's crazy.
Well, they're filling out a template, basically a checkbox,
Yeah.
right? But they're doing it because they know that that's what they're asked to do.
And it's usually not zero and 100.
Right,
It's
exactly.
usually something other than zero and 100. Yet in our
Sure.
industry, where presumably you've got the experts, it's hardly ever anything but zero or
Yeah, you
100.
don't see a high percentage of comparative negligence applied.
No. It's I know, you know, years ago we had actually measured it in our organization, and we were at about 3% of claims. That was very, very, very low. And you know, we took some proactive measures and rolled out some tools and things that were supposed to help us. I think we got the number up to like 15%. Took a while, but there were offices, in particular in places like New York and California, you know, pure comparative states that were, you know, hitting it at a third. I mean, they were, you know, which isn't bad when you figure, you know, primarily auto claims, and half of them are going to be, you know, rear-enders, which, you know, you can usually argue 100 on those. But
Usually.
usually, I mean, there's always the broken tail light. But you know, getting a third of the rest, you know, it's not bad. But you know, but the industry as a whole, I mean, definitely opportunities. And you know, I think, you know, my youngest is an adjuster, and he went through training. And I bet you, I'll ask him, but I bet you they haven't had a negotiation class since, you know.
Yeah, I think there's you get one as an adjuster, and that's pretty
Yeah.
much it.
And then you got to learn. I mean, honestly, I think I learned, probably you're in a similar situation. You learn from the people around you, right? I mean, you'd
Listening.
listen to the people on the phone with the body shops and the attorneys, and you'd be like, I never thought of that. And you figure out what works and what doesn't work.
That proximity experience that you and I learned from
Right.
is really not around much anymore with work from home. And
Yeah.
I mean, you can't just look over a wall and listen to somebody or talk to your neighbor because you're in your house.
Right.
And I have lamented the loss of that experiential learning for a while. But I think there's technologies that can help us overcome that. I don't think they're ever going to be a full replacement for it, but
Right.
definitely can overcome it. And then you and I were talking about, AI is here to stay.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And it's going to be used in a lot of different areas that probably we haven't even thought about yet.
Right.
But when I was teaching my MBA course, I learned to write AI prompts. And
Right.
this is most people just use AI like Google.
Yeah.
And if you're using AI like Google, you're really not leveraging the power of AI. But so I learned to write AI prompts. There are anywhere from 8 to 10 to 12 pages long. So
Okay.
they're big developed prompts. And you can actually use it to create simulations. So back when I was 35 years ago, when I was an adjuster, I mentioned to you that one of the ways that I learned was through role play.
Right.
And it was uncomfortable and I hated it, and harbored ill feelings for the person that I was on the other end of the call with for a while. But I don't even think we do role play anymore. But you can set up AI to actually do a role play simulation with you, and it's comfortable and it's safe,
Right.
and you get feedback on how you did. So I also mentioned the G. Richard Schell book a few
Right.
minutes ago. That to me is kind of classic negotiation theory. And there are other books out there on negotiation. I think Voss has a book on negotiation. You can find a ton of them, but this one to me was very, very logical. So I used the points that the author was making in his negotiation theory to
Right.
write this prompt that would then, when you were done negotiating the simulation, that it would give you feedback based on the content of the book.
Okay.
It would identify the author identify like five negotiating styles. There's avoiding, accommodating, competing, collaborating, and compromising. Those are the five
Okay.
negotiating styles. And the thing is, like, you have to realize what your own negotiating style is when you're in the middle of a negotiation.
Makes sense. Yeah. So what's your negotiating style?
Well, it depends on when you take it.
Okay.
But mine was collaborating. So it's like finding common ground and, trying to, and this is with your co-negotiator. So if you like, there's always middle ground somewhere. So a collaborator is one that is skilled in helping to find that middle ground. But it's also, so if I'm negotiating with you, and let's say you are a competing negotiator and I am a collaborating negotiator, we're going to have trouble because competing is, if you're a competing style, there, negotiation is a zero-sum game. You win, I lose. If I
So
win,
it's
you
never the win,
lose.
it's never the win-win.
Never the win-win, right? So the other thing that this prompt will help you do, or it's designed to do, is to help you recognize who is negotiating on the other end. So you have to identify their style so that you can modify yours in order to have a successful outcome.
I mean, it makes sense. I mean, you want to understand, the other side,
Yeah.
obviously. And I mean, I would think you'd have to take a different tactic, right? So if I'm a collaborative and you're competing,
Yeah.
I'm gonna have to probably adopt more of your style then.
Well, you really have to understand BATNA. If I use the term BATNA, you're familiar with that?
No.
So it's the best alternative to a negotiated agreement. That's part of negotiation theory. So everyone has a BATNA. In claims speak, BATNA to a failed negotiation would be mediation or arbitration or a lawsuit. So basically, what can you do if you're not successful in negotiating? So if I'm coming up against a competing person and they're playing that zero-sum game and trying to beat me down, well, BATNA becomes my way out because then I don't have to, agree to what they're doing, what they're negotiating, but I have an alternative. And you just have to know what your alternatives are.
And I mean, in our world, obviously there are alternatives, and I think, I mean, mediation is, I mean, I always thought that pre-suit mediation was a good way to resolve claims. I mean, I know you're paying a mediator. Obviously, there's costs there, but when you can't resolve it, rather than spend, months and months and thousands of dollars in court, let's try to settle it. Let's go, you think your case is worth a lot, I think it's worth a little. Let's agree on a mediator and let's just do a pre-suit mediation. We'll split the costs. And those always seem to resolve themselves.
Well, what's kind of interesting is, what another name for a mediator is? A negotiator. I mean, they're basically just negotiating. That's what they're doing, but they're negotiating with two different parties, right? And that's you're taking your negotiation to a mediator, but in essence, you're continuing your negotiating. You've got someone else that's then trying to either talk sense or present evidence that, why the position isn't unreasonable or is unreasonable. So that helps. Bringing in a third party is a way to deal with a competing negotiator.
And it makes sense. So I wonder across the populace, what is the percentage in each of those buckets? Is it fairly evenly distributed?
Well, I don't know the answer to that in the general population. I know that I've been using this in my company, trying to get people to take this online assessment that tells them and me what their negotiating style is. And about 40% so far are collaborating in my company. So it could be different at other companies. So you just take a body of people, there's an online assessment, and it tells you what your
I mean,
negotiations are.
that's probably, I mean, it's probably not a bad thing if 40% are collab, because I would look at those different styles and think collaborative is probably, the ideal negotiating style, because you're trying to find common ground and a solution,
Right.
and
Yeah.
everybody wins at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Where, the competing, it's like, nobody wants to win, and
Well, only one
it's
person wins.
and that's that's and yeah, no, I think this is some fascinating stuff. So what's next with your AI prompts? You got
Well, I've used four or five different AI prompts for different things,
okay.
but one of the things that I'm trying to use for the negotiating one is if we find out, for instance, if our company style is collaborating,
Yep.
well, we need to develop, we're going to focus training on the collaborating style,
Yeah.
right? So we just kind of enable, because you have to use your default style. Everyone has a default style.
Right.
You have to use that to maximize your result in negotiating. If you
Right.
don't know how to do that,
Yeah.
then you're not going to be effective. So I'm using this now to figure out, first off, it's kind of a fun game to do,
Sure.
running the AI prompt. So that makes it a lot easier for people to fill it out,
Right.
because otherwise, you're like, hey, will you take a survey?
Right.
And then you get like 15% of the people that actually take the survey
Right.
when you ask a group.
Yep.
So this at least makes it fun. It's interactive, and you can get a result, and then we're going to use it to develop training to train our negotiators using their default style.
And that makes a lot of sense. I mean, look, in this day and age where negotiations become kind of a lost art, I think that, having a team of people that can negotiate gives you a huge competitive advantage.
Yeah, for sure. Well, and there are, we obviously work with hundreds and hundreds of thousands of clients,
Right.
and there are some accounts that have negotiation teams.
Right.
So when a claim gets to the point where it's time to be negotiated, it's moved to a negotiator,
Yeah.
basically. And then that's their job, is just all day to sit there and to negotiate.
Yep.
I think there's been varying levels of success in that. With, I mean, if you're a claims person, what's the thing that you hate the most? It's probably getting a claim reassigned from someone
Yeah.
else, right?
Yeah, we've all been there. Yep.
Because you gotta, go through the file and try to understand where they're at and understand all the points. So, and leverage in a negotiation is critical to getting a good outcome.
Right.
And that leverage comes from the investigation and what we were talking about earlier.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
And the thing is, I mean, it happens a lot these days, it seems, that back in the day when we were coming up, we used to handle the claim from beginning,
Right, soup
right?
to nuts.
And now it seems like you a lot of times have a front-end liability adjuster that might handle the property damage, and because they're pushing disposition numbers, they're paying 100% on everything, gets to the BI adjuster that might be a little more tenured. It's like, wait a minute, there's cotton egg on this. And
Right.
I mean, you just did this and you put me in a really bad spot,
Right.
because now I've got to negotiate from behind, and you got the plaintiff attorney saying, well, you paid my client 100%.
Yes, and that
And it's
happens.
it happens a lot.
Yeah.
And that's, number one, it's bad practice. Number two, it's a lot of leakage. I
Yeah, for
mean, you
sure.
start adding that up.
Yeah. So the bifurcating of the claim, that started probably 15, 20 years ago,
Yeah.
where we started to break it out. And I think there's good reasons for that.
Sure.
But there is a downside, and that's the downside that you've just talked about.
Yeah, I mean, it's always slight. I mean, I don't know what the perfect solution is. I mean, I loved how I came up just because of what I learned, but I also know it's a very high cost model.
Yes,
I
it
mean, you
is.
think of the cost, especially with the price of, cars and gas these days, putting everybody in company cars and sending them out on the road. I mean, you can settle a lot of overpriced BIs by just bringing people in the office. So
Right.
it's, yeah, I don't know what the perfect solution is, but I think what you're working on is a really good solution. And I, look forward to, hearing more about it. And
We got to improve our negotiation ability.
we do 100%, especially in an industry that's driven by negotiation.
Right.
So, and at the end of the day, these people that aren't negotiating, when they're going out to buy a car, they're negotiating.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, I want $500 off whatever. It's like, bring that to the office.
Yeah.
So, but Steve, it was great to have you here. Thank you so much for
Appreciate
joining
it.
us. And if people want to learn more about Sedgwick, where are
Yeah.
they? Sedgwick.com?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Sedgwick.com, or they can reach out to me.
Perfect. Great. Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you for joining the Claim Hunters. We hope you enjoyed our show. If you would like to share your story, head on over to subroiq.com and click the YouTube button.